It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about real-time virus monitoring through air sampling technology and the results of a study in the Oregon School District to monitor and track circulating viruses like flu and COVID-19. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Temte is here, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement and a Professor of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Temte, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much, Kate, and happy Leap Day to you.
And to you. So you installed these air samplers to test for viruses in some schools in Oregon, the school district south of Madison. Why did you decide on schools as the venue?
Well, schools are really important venues for both the transmission and acceleration of respiratory infections within our communities. And so, using the old adage, why do you rob banks? It's because the money's there. And in schools, that's where the viruses tend to be.
And I understand you've been testing in the Oregon schools for some time, over a decade. Can you talk a little bit about this type of longer-term disease study program?
Absolutely. We have had the wonderful situation of being funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention since 2013. And our study was mainly aimed at looking at whether or not we could use absenteeism for a early detection method for influenza in the community. And so since about 2014, we've been monitoring total influenza and or total absenteeism due to illness. And then we look at absenteeism due to a flu-like illness. And what we found is that absenteeism works actually very good in giving us a head start on detecting influenza in the community. We were in place when COVID hit, and so we've been able to do the same with COVID. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to add in some additional methods for looking for these viruses.
And so air samplers now being in the mix and kind of can be able to track things like influenza and circulating COVID. In terms of what these air samplers can do, what about other highly contagious viruses, like the disease measles, can it track for that?
More than likely, the answer is yes, but one has to be cautious because one really has to do the testing to make sure that what you're seeing in the air sample is actually what is happening within the population. So one has to be really, really cautious because if you have a false positive signal, basically identifying something that really isn't there, the public health response cost is really, really large. So I think we have to be careful in the application. The good news is for both influenza and for COVID-19, we've done that preliminary groundwork, and this methodology seems to work actually very well.
We're talking about air sampling to detect viruses with Dr. Jonathan Temte at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Call in with questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Temte, what advantages are there in testing air samples for viruses rather than, say, physically testing people in a community?
Well, first, the air sampling is actually very, very easy. You put a device in an area that there are a lot of people, for example, a cafeteria, you turn it on, and then you just come by occasionally and pull cartridges out. Secondly, air sampling is totally anonymous. So we're getting results, but without tracking it to an individual person. And so for people who are concerned about privacy, this really is a nice technique. And I'd say the third thing is it isn't really behavioral dependent. So when we're doing our studies, we're dependent on parents calling in saying that they have a sick child. And there can be a lot of things out there that will prompt that. For example, the news media is saying, oh, we're in the middle of a flu epidemic, that might prompt parents to be more likely to call into our study line. So the error sampling provides us a tool that is pretty unbiased, it's anonymous, and it gives us good results.
So I imagine researchers have learned a lot about the spread of disease since the arrival of COVID-19. And you were testing for COVID in the Oregon schools. How did the spread of COVID respond to things like masking or physical distancing and school closures?
Wonderful questions. Well, I have to admit that I think our team detected the very first case of household transmission in the state of Wisconsin back just a little bit over 4 years ago now. But the things that I think are really important out there is that we found through another system that we have been monitoring households within our Oregon school district, that there were some profound effects on what the school district did. So initially, on the 13th of March of 2020, schools shut down basically across the nation. And what we found in households that were part of our study, the respiratory infections totally disappeared very, very quickly. During the first fall, when students came back, but came back with hybrid education, so only half of them were there at any time, they had mandatory masking and they had distancing within schools, we found that there was very little respiratory virus transmission going on. The following year, students came back with mandatory masking, but without distancing, without hybrid. And sure enough, we saw some viruses leap back into circulation, particularly the common cold virus or something called rhinovirus. And then the following year, when kids came back without masking, without distancing, without hybrid, it was just kind of the Wild West. There was everything circulating very early and very intensely. So we have a really nice set of information that we can look at what the school was doing and what the response was within the community.
What you described there is pretty ideal for researchers to make some really important strides here in understanding, how our viruses circulate and how to shut them down.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the benefits we've had, as I mentioned early on, is this continuous funding. And when we finish up, it will have been 11 years. And that is really, really, really uncommon within epidemiology and within the scientific community in general. So we have been very, very lucky.
So, how would detecting viruses through these air samplers, these systems, how would that augment other detection methods? Is it a complement to other methods?
Yeah, absolutely. In our studies, we actually have 10 different methodologies that we're all doing at the same time within the same population. And we're able to compare them with each other. In the paper that we published recently, we looked at four of those. But now we're doing some further analytics on 10 different methods. And what I'll say is each one has properties that have benefits and advantages and some that have some negativity and costs and so on. And at the end of the day, I think any group who is interested in monitoring might have a whole palette of different techniques to choose from and adapt for their local circumstances.
We have Dr. Jonathan Tumpty with us, Professor of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can be part of the conversation on air sampling, monitors, virus surveillance technology. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore tech advancements and disease surveillance, and we unpack results of a study published in JAMA Network Open about the effectiveness of air samplers to detect the presence of influenza and COVID-19 at sites in the Oregon School District. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at UW School of Medicine and Public Health and lead author of this study. Dr. Tempty, let's get into a bit of the nuts and bolts here of these air sampler devices. How do they collect and test genetic material?
The devices are pretty much like a small vacuum cleaner that's constantly pulling air out of circulation and pushing it through a small filter that's designed to capture genetic material. The cartridge is then removed, and in this study, the cartridges were being removed twice a week and going to the laboratory of Dr. David and Dr. Shelby O'Connor up on the UW campus. They extracted the genetic material and then tested it in their laboratory for the presence of influenza and for SARS-CoV-2 or the cause of COVID-19. So it's a fairly straightforward process, but I would also argue that it's not necessarily easy or cheap at this point in time. So this is not a type of approach that one can go into a hardware store and pick up the components and have it up and running. This is something that in our situation was really a research endeavor.
I would imagine too, when there is an outbreak, speed matters, your timeliness and knowing matters so you can make critical decisions, whether you're a school or a nursing home. How rapid could the turnaround results be on air samplers?
Well, one of the things that we've been interested in using are some of the small devices that have been created, designed, and marketed for very rapid detection of pathogens. So, for example, there are tools that are called rapid molecular detection tests that can give a result within, let's say, 30 minutes of the time that a sample is taken from someone's nose or presumably from a cartridge. So stay tuned for this, but I think the arc that we're seeing is toward cheaper, faster, and higher accuracy.
Could these cartridges that are pulled out of these machines, could they be used, could they be reused or recycled? What is the cycle here for waste?
Well, this is a great question that I would probably defer to my colleagues, Dave and Shelby O'Connor. But they have explored in creating their own cartridges, and the material is actually very, very small. The cartridge is about the size of, let's say, a large pen. And so they're actually quite small. The other thing is these can be checked or pulled out at any period of time. It could be done daily. It could be done twice a week. It could be done weekly. And so these are all protocols that, let's say, are, you know, in the process of being worked out.
And how portable could these units be? Could you move them around a facility based on the needs or the collective areas where people might be congregating?
Yeah, absolutely. These are the size of between a toaster and a toaster oven. They're actually very small, compact, lightweight, and easy to move.
Do you imagine that costs would eventually come down with this technology? And do you think there's a demand for it?
Well, I think one has to think in terms of where the most appropriate place could be. And as I mentioned earlier, schools are really important hubs of transmission, particularly for things like influenza and SARS-CoV-2. And even things like, if we go back in time, measles. But we have to also think about where are the highest consequences. And those might be more in terms of our long-term care facilities, where we have congregations of much more vulnerable individuals. And so in a school, what you're doing is detecting the occurrence of a pathogen in the community. In a nursing home, you're looking at the arrival of a pathogen in a highly vulnerable population. And if you're able to intervene early on, you may be able to save illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. And so one has to really cautiously and appropriately apply the technology to the situation.
Talking with Dr. Jonathan Tempty at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and research on air sampling technology to detect viruses. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. How soon, timeline here, how soon could air samplers be installed in large numbers of public places? Do you see a future for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my colleagues have been working a little bit deploying these in places like points of entry, airports, international arrivals. And again, as opposed to requiring or asking passengers to submit a nasal swab, this is pretty much hands-off and anonymous. And so it can provide that early warning without really being a intervention that causes delays, causes other consternation. So I think I'd say stay tuned and let's see where this technology goes.
When I was reading your study, there were things that you're comparing with, like swabs, as you mentioned, and absenteeism. But I also saw the word dogs in there. And, that's like being like seeing that little shiny thing on the side. Where do dogs come in circulating viruses?
Well, that was mentioned in our introduction, and
Yes.
just as to the variety of things that people have looked at. And there was a school district, I believe in California, that looked at whether or not dogs could be trained to recognize the scent of a person or a child infected with COVID. And it showed moderate benefit. But that also brings up the whole issue of wastewater sampling.
Yes.
And all I can say is our state lab of hygiene is a center of excellence for wastewater surveillance, looking for things like influenza, COVID-19, and RSV. And so there are all these technologies that are being developed simultaneously, and we'll see which ones have the most promise.
So, if there is another widespread pandemic, the tools in our toolbox now, have we learned a lot here? And are air samplers a tool that could be readily used in the future if we're in the face of another pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to leave all of our cards on the table and again, apply them appropriately for the situation. But again, the air sampling can give us this early warning. It can detect things in very small amounts. And I have to just insert right here that we're not detecting viruses that are going to be infecting people in the air. We're detecting the genetic material. So one has to be cautious in interpreting our results, saying, oh my goodness, the air is contaminated and we're going to be sick by walking through this cafeteria. That isn't the case.
Quick question here in our closing moments. Kevin in Janesville wonders if this technology could sample large buildings like a prison or a mall.
This is really dependent on the number of people in an area, the airflow. So if there's a high rate ventilation system, it's going to be less effective. And so it really depends on the situation. And again, part of the studies that my colleagues, David and Shelby O'Connor, are doing are looking at things like the airflow and the most appropriate deployment or location for these devices to be.
Dr. Tempty, thanks for joining us.
Well, very welcome and thanks for having me.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The gap in wealth between white families and families of color has grown over decades. We examine efforts by the Chicago branch of the Federal Reserve to tackle systemic inequalities. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about survival.
Dreaming can help some people get through incredibly difficult times. Madison's Tondalea Taylor talks about how daydreaming helped her overcome a major health crisis and appreciate everyday life.
You want to know what I love? I love traveling, great earrings and purses. I mean, who wouldn't love to shop every day, all day, with not a care or worry in the world? I envision myself walking through the airport with my favorite pair of Black Queen earrings, my cute matching crossbody purse, taking a first-class flight to the Bahamas. I find myself doing that all too often. When I daydream, it was starting to affect my day job. Daydreaming was good to me until I had an unexpected visitor that would put my daydreaming into jeopardy. I had been feeling horrible for a few months. I was so tired, I almost couldn't make it to the doctor appointment. I finally dragged myself to the doctor. Never planned out in my mind that I would drive to the doctor, but I would ride in the ambulance to the emergency room. 8 hours later, one doctor came in and said, "You look good compared to what your body is going through, so we're going to keep you overnight." I suddenly had a sigh of relief. After another doctor came in and told me he ran every test he could possibly run, and he said I had leukemia. Then I called my mom and said they think I have cancer, even though he was truly sure that's what it was. I called my mama because I wanted her to call him and tell him about himself. Don't be telling her baby she got cancer like that one time she told the school worker not to be talking down on her kids. Or like that one time she told our babysitter, "Don't tell us we can't eat our food." Then, finally moved to my first room after being admitted into the hospital. It was the ICU. It was never told to me what stage cancer I was in. I was always told it's aggressive. After 8 rounds of chemo, after 2 bone marrow tests, after various trips to the hospital for infections, after losing my hair, after 4 non-successful tries of getting stem cells, after telling my son I had cancer, after not having an appetite, after many restless nights, after not being able to daydream about traveling to places with no signs of cold weather anywhere, I finally got good news. Besides finding out the chemo was working, there was no evidence of the disease. I got stem cells. I made them on my own with the booster shot, of course. For these new stem cells I was about to receive, I'm going in the hospital for 1 month, take chemo for 7 days. This may have been the hardest chemo I have ever gotten, but I made it to transplant day. Wipe my system out and receive a new beginning. It's like filing Chapter 7 bankruptcy in my body. I wanted to go home and heal there. I'm living my life after cancer. I enjoy every day as my last because I don't know how much time I have here. Wow. One thing I was always worried about is if the cancer will ever come back. The thing about cancer is that it's not a cure, so I'm not fully cured of cancer. I'm just living my life like it doesn't exist. This time, when I daydream, is really to take the trip to the Bahamas with my new surviving cancer earrings and I survived cancer t-shirt. The biggest daydream is really a reality because it involves being cancer-free.
Tondalea Taylor's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project. Taylor was also a guest on the new podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the staggering wealth gap between Black and white Americans and a project by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago to promote policies that could help to narrow these vast differences in household wealth. The Chicago Fed's territory includes 46 counties of southern Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Brody is a senior economist at the Chicago Fed and is director of its Economic Mobility Project. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Your research says that white households have a median net worth that's nearly eight times greater than Black households, and that data taken in 2019. How does that gap compare to previous surveys?
So if we look at it, so the Survey of Consumer Finance comes out every 3 years, right? So in 2016, the average white household had a median net worth that was 9.9 times greater than the average Black household. That decreased in 2019. And it decreased again in 2022. But if we look at the multiplier, right, like the multiplier is decreasing, but the number is increasing, right? So the gap is 240,000. So it really depends on, are you talking about the multiplier decreasing or the dollar amount increasing? And when we look at the dollar amount, we see that it's getting worse. I would also add that the 2022 Survey of Consumer Finance is the first year that Asian Americans were added as a separate category, and their median net worth was $536,000. That's 2.8 times greater than the average white household, right? So, yeah, there are a couple of different gaps that we're looking at.
Okay, so what might be happening there?
Well, we see that Asian American people are more likely to own businesses than other minority groups, that those businesses have higher revenues, that they're more likely to be employer businesses rather than sole proprietorships. We also see them having the highest incomes and being more likely to get a college degree and a master's degree, which, of course, increases income.
And you highlight in your report that business ownership is a key driver of wealth. Is there adequate minority entrepreneurship to be able to close the racial wealth gap?
No, there's not. So we have seen an uptick in business applications and businesses getting started in particularly Black and Latino majority counties during the pandemic, but many of them are sole proprietorships. So they're not necessarily in employing other people, right? And the other thing that you have to look at is how those businesses are doing 4 years after they open. And we see that Black and Latino businesses are less likely to be in operation 4 years later. So we need to figure out, how do we support these businesses so that they can thrive, employ people, and serve their communities?
Turning to labor unions, which may be part of some businesses, last summer a Gallup poll found nearly 70% of Americans approve of labor unions. That's nearly the highest level of support since the 60s. How are labor unions affecting household wealth and the racial wealth gap?
So we know that when you have labor unions, people are likely to earn higher wages. Research has shown that for many years. And we know that African Americans have the highest union membership rate. So that's definitely a good thing, right? And we did see, you know, several strikes last summer. We are seeing people earning higher wages, but the fact is that none of these things alone, fixing any of these things, would not solve the racial wealth gap. It's been going on since 1870, since Black people were freed from slavery, right? So, and at that time, the racial wealth gap between Black people and white people was 23-1. So this disadvantage has been going on for 152 years as of the 2022 Survey of Consumer Finance.
economists were able to learn things during the pandemic. Your report says college enrollment rose in 2023 by 2.1%, and that's the first time since the start of the pandemic. What can you tell us there, that the enrollment rise largely driven by students of color? What impact could that have?
So, of course, when people earn a college degree, particularly a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, we do see that their incomes increase. But we have to look at how is higher education funded? And so we know that a lot of people take on student loans. Mm. And looking at how are those loans paid back? So if we look at the average amount borrowed as of 4 years after 2015 or 2016, bachelor's degree completion, and these are federal loans. So we would see that African Americans borrowed the highest amount at $58,400. And 4 years later, they owe 105% of that. Just for comparison, white students borrowed $43,300 and owed 73% of that. Asian Americans borrowed $49,100 and owed 63% of that. So, of course, we want to encourage students to go to school, to get a higher education, to get a technical school education or something so that they can get a job. But we have to look at how that money is being paid back and how paying back that money impacts the ability to get a mortgage and buy a house, which is another source of wealth.
I think that what those numbers that show in terms of the loans and the payback, it helps to illustrate why education alone can't shrink the racial wealth gap.
They could if people were able to pay them back, right? Mm-hmm. So with the ratios that we're looking at, again, like 4 years later, Black students on average owe 105%. So they owe more than they took out, right? So there's got to be some type of rebalancing there so that higher education becomes more affordable for more Americans.
Kristen Brody is with us, senior economist at the Chicago Fed, directs the Fed's economic mobility project that we are unpacking. You can be part of the discussion about the racial wealth gap. Call in with a question, add your viewpoint, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to your listener requests, Randy by email and Tom in Madison, we learn about food additives, these chemicals that could pose a health risk. Here's Tom.
A lot of these additives are banned in Europe, but not in this country here. They're in baked goods, candy, and soda. Our food is not that safe as we think.
Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Faber is Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. That's a nonprofit advocacy organization. Scott, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
So the Food and Drug Administration regulates these food additives. How are additives commonly used in food?
Oh, gosh, I think we all take for granted that we're eating chemicals every time we eat processed food, but there are chemicals added to our food to make it last longer, taste better, smell better, for our salad dressing to stay emulsified, to stay in solution. There are myriad ways that chemicals have made processed food something that we all enjoy. But as your listener, Tom, said, and he got it exactly right, the vast, vast majority of these chemicals are never reviewed for safety by the FDA. In fact, 99% of them are deemed safe by the chemical companies that make them, not by our regulators. So to say that they're regulated is sort of an exaggeration.
And I see that number over 10,000 being allowed in things that we consume. Do we know enough about what these chemicals do to people?
We really don't. And there's been a real regulatory black hole when it comes to food chemicals, almost since Congress told the FDA way back in 1958 to make sure, now that people were routinely eating chemicals, to make sure they were safe. And at the time, Congress imagined that FDA would review every one of those 10,000 or so chemicals, but the FDA pretty quickly got overwhelmed and said, you know what, we're going to let the chemical industry decide. And even when the FDA itself does review one of these chemicals for safety and asks, you know, is eating this chemical every day over our lifetime going to increase our risk of cancer or other health harms, even when FDA does ask those questions, they oftentimes don't go back and reassess the judgments they have made maybe 10, 20, sometimes even 50 years later. So there are some chemicals that have been reviewed by FDA, but many of them, even when they've been reviewed by FDA, haven't been reviewed in many, many decades, longer than most of your listeners have been alive.
And so the FDA allows certain additives to be considered, quote, generally recognized as safe and to avoid further review prior to market. How much do these rules affect additives in food?
Yeah, so Congress, when it created the modern law to review these chemicals for safety, Congress said, we want, hey, FDA, people are eating chemicals that were recently used in military applications. We'd like you to make sure they're safe. But Congress also included a loophole in the law called the Generally Recognized as Safe, or GRAS loophole, for chemicals that were obviously safe, that were so obviously safe that it would be a waste of the government's time to even ask whether they're safe. And at the time, Congress sort of imagined those would be things like vinegar and things like that. And of course, what's happened in the 60 plus years since then is that the loophole has swallowed the entire law. That at the time, Congress imagined 99% of chemicals would be reviewed by FDA and maybe 1% would come in through this loophole. Well, now it's the opposite. And since 2000, 99% of the chemicals, food chemicals that have come into commerce and that are used in our food every day, have been reviewed by the chemical companies. And guess what? Every time they review them, they're safe. Mm-hmm. Only 1% of the chemicals that have come into commerce since 2000 have been reviewed by the regulators at FDA, the folks who don't have a conflict of interest.
That loophole you describe that has gotten larger over generations, that is unsettling.
It is. I think a lot of folks, and in particular a lot of state legislators, are just figuring this out. I think we all go to the grocery store. I used to work for food companies. Even I assumed when I started working for food companies, gosh, all these chemicals we eat every day, that someone's reviewed them, someone we can trust has reviewed them. And I think most of us, probably many of the people who are listening to us right now, are thinking, wait a minute, all those chemicals on the back of the bag or bottle or box of processed food, on my cereal box that I ate this morning, all those chemicals are being reviewed for safety by the chemical companies. I think a lot of folks are learning for the first time, including a lot of state legislators, that the FDA has really exited the field. That wasn't what Congress intended, but that's what's happened. And so, of course, there are certainly people who are looking for ways to avoid these chemicals. They're reading labels. They're choosing organic, which has very many fewer of these chemicals allowed in organic processed food. But most of us are just happily assuming that the FDA's got our back. And unfortunately, that's not the case.
Scott Faber is with us at the Environmental Working Group as we talk about food additives and what is in the food we consume. You can call in with questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Scott, we're going to look at the meat category, the FDA working with USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to approve food additives in meat and poultry. And state estimates show Wisconsin exported nearly $4 billion in ag and food products to 142 countries last year. Which food additives can be used in meat?
Oh, gosh. And this was a big shocker for me as well, that so many hundreds of different food chemicals have been approved by the USDA for use in meat, poultry, egg products. The USDA does not themselves review these chemicals for safety. They have an agreement, an MOU with the FDA that they rely on. And like the rest of us, the USDA assumes the FDA has reviewed these chemicals for safety. Now we all know that's by and large not the choice. Most of these chemicals are probably safe. Well, you know, in most cases, again, we have to take the chemical industry's word for it. But a few of the chemicals that are used in meat and dairy products have posed health risks. And as Tom, the listener at the top of your broadcast, mentioned, many of them have been banned or severely restricted in other countries in the EU and elsewhere. A couple of examples is a preservative that's often used in meat called BHA. BHA is a preservative that hasn't been reviewed by anyone in our government since the 1990s. It's considered a potential carcinogen by the state of California, but it's commonly used in many meat products, even though there are lots of cheaper, in many cases, alternatives available for use as a preservative. It's used in things like sliced meat and pepperoni, I'm sorry to say, brats, and for Wisconsin listeners. So and I think the thing that many of your listeners are probably thinking about, as I'm sure you are, is, wait a minute, there are safer, cheaper alternatives, and why aren't companies using it? And the answer is because they don't have to, right? Mm-hmm. And while there is a modest cost, really an inconvenience associated with changing recipes, companies are not going to change their recipes unless the FDA or USDA or a state agency or regulator says they have to.
Scott Faber is a Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. You can be part of this conversation about food additives. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine potentially harmful ingredients commonly found in processed foods and drinks. California has a first-in-the-nation ban on 4 of these additives, and there is proposed legislation in Illinois, our neighbor, that would go further to crack down on specific chemicals. Call in with a question. You can add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Scott Faber with us, Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Let's bring in Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Good morning. A few years ago, when baby formula became unavailable in America, America was bringing in the baby formula from Europe. And yet, if you look at the label of a lot of baby formulas, you may find additives and other chemicals, because when the formula was unavailable, many mothers tried to call in and explain how they fed their babies before formulas were even available at all on the market. And all of those suggestions were greatly decried. And yet, I do believe that if you closely look at baby formula, you will find that that is one of the first processed food. So even though WHAD has had many programs advising people to avoid processed foods, when lobbyists in Washington were persuading pediatricians across the whole world that only their specific Similac and other products should be fed to babies, they were indeed introducing the first processed food while the baby is still in its cradle.
Nancy, thank you for that call. Scott Faber, what can you tell us about baby formula?
Yeah, well, of course, the biggest risk posed to our babies from baby formula are not the ingredients, but the risk that they become contaminated with a terrible pathogen, Chronobacter, that can occur in a baby formula manufacturing plant when certain food safety precautions haven't been taken. And as everyone, I'm sure, and Nancy, of course, remembers, but everyone on this call remembers, the discovery of Chronobacter in a plant in Michigan ultimately led to the death of some babies and caused massive shortages that were not addressed until we began to import and other countries' baby formula. So by far the biggest threat posed by baby formula are not the ingredients, but the risk from this terrible pathogen, Chronobacter. And what's interesting about it, or important, especially for this conversation, is FDA's failure to catch this food safety problem at this one particular facility, even though an FDA inspector had been in the facility, really has led to a dramatic reckoning at FDA. That's, among other things, has led to a change in leadership and a reorganization. One of the consequences of that reorganization is that FDA is at least saying they will make the safety of these sorts of food chemicals that we're talking about, preservatives, colors, flavors, and so on, a bigger priority for FDA. They certainly haven't been for the last 60 plus years, and they've hired someone to run this part of FDA that has a lot of experience regulating chemicals. But the time will tell whether or not the culture change that needs to happen at FDA really takes hold.
Well, let's talk about the legislation afoot here. We see Illinois lawmakers proposing banning 5 food additives by 2027. And then, you know, last October, California bans 4 food additives that goes in effect in that same year. So which food additives are state lawmakers concerned about?
Yeah, well, Kate, as some of your listeners know, because this bill in California did get a lot of national and even international attention, California legislators banned 4 chemicals. A number of them were preservatives that had not been reviewed by the government for more than 50 years. For example, one is a propylparaben, a preservative that's used in products like tortillas. The legislators in California also banned a chemical used in citrus sodas called BVO that FDA actually sought to ban in the 1970s, but reversed itself after pressure from soda manufacturers. And then another one that was banned was Red 3, a color that FDA had banned from use in cosmetics more than 50 years ago, but still permitted for use in food. And think of the red colors and candies and cakes and so on. And even though the Red 3 was linked to cancer, and so all of these chemicals were linked to serious health harms. But what ultimately led the California legislature to ban these 4 chemicals was their recognition that FDA had really wasn't looking out for consumers. That, in fact, if state legislators like those in California and potentially in Illinois don't act, there really isn't anyone looking out for consumers. And that may change. There may be change at FDA, but for the moment, our really only line of defense is our state legislatures or what consumers do on their own when they're in the grocery aisle.
So, how are manufacturers of these products responding? I'm wondering, like, are they just swapping out then red dye number 3 for red number 40?
Yeah, no, and there's a real risk of that. And you know, obviously, we don't want chemical companies or food companies to replace one dangerous chemical with another dangerous chemical or slightly less dangerous chemical. The problem of regrettable substitution, as toxicologists and regulatory scientists describe it. It's why we ought to have a regulator at FDA sort of looking across these thousands of chemicals and helping make good decisions. But until then, state regulators are going to have to make sure that we address the most dangerous chemicals. And again, while while many, there are many thousands of chemicals that are used in food, it's probably not even hundreds or even scores that are posing, we know pose health risks. And so what California and now Illinois, New York, Washington, South Dakota, Missouri, and a number of other states are doing is really looking to other countries and to the peer-reviewed science to say, well, some of these chemicals are pretty obviously bad. There's animal studies or non-animal studies that show that they cause serious health harms, including cancer in some cases. We have to start somewhere. So we're going to start by removing the worst of the worst chemicals. And chemicals like Red 3, BHA, the one I mentioned that's used in meat, BHT, another preservative that's also used in meat and dairy products. Those are among the chemicals that really ought to go while we wait for the FDA to do what Congress asked them to do way back in 1958.
Scott Faber with us from the National Nonprofit Environmental Working Group as we discuss food additives and where it is headed. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Scott, I just want to bring up titanium dioxide, which I think California left out of its Food Safety Act, and yet Illinois is including. What is the distinction there with that chemical?
Yeah, well, there are lots of reasons to be concerned about ingesting titanium dioxide. It was banned by the European Food Safety Authority, the government body that regulates these chemicals in Europe, because of concerns that titanium dioxide, which is used in products like Skittles, could harm our DNA, that it was genotoxic. Wow. And that in particular, that very, very small particles of titanium dioxide could get lodged in our intestine. So again, there's evidence of harm. There are also alternatives available. We make Skittles in Europe without titanium dioxide. So, you know, this isn't like a cancer drug that we simply can't live without. These are chemicals or substances that are really easy to replace. Oftentimes, the alternatives are cheaper. And the fact that you can buy Skittles in many other countries without titanium dioxide is really the best evidence that, you know, companies that make Skittles just don't need titanium dioxide. So the science is compelling, but what's even more compelling are the economics, right? Mm. That this would be a virtually costless change in the recipe of Skittles that would have no effect whatsoever on the price that folks pay at the grocery store or the CVS.
Have organic products kind of figured this out, the economics and otherwise here, and left behind all of the other products? Or what can we learn from the organic marketplace?
Yeah, no, you know, it's sort of a great secret success story, I think, especially in Wisconsin, because of the presence of Organic Valley. So many folks know that organic means no toxic pesticides. You can't use sewage sludge. You can't have genetically engineered ingredients, and you can't use antibiotics. What many people don't know about organic, and especially in the center of the store, all those organic processed foods, is that less than 40 of these 10,000 or so food chemicals, less than 40 of those chemicals can be used in organic food.
Well, let's
which
pause.
Is pretty remarkable.
Yes, let's pause right there with Scott Faber, leads government affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to listener requests, we examine risks associated with chemicals added to food and drinks. The World Health Organization says many different food additives have been developed over time to meet the needs of large-scale food processing. Call in with a question. Add your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Faber heads up government affairs at the advocacy organization Environmental Working Group. Let's bring in Helen in La Crosse. Helen, hi.
Good morning. You were just starting to talk organic, and I had purchased a pancake and waffle mix. It's called Organic Traditions, and this is USDA organic. And when I turn the package over on the very bottom, which I did not see when I purchased it, it says California Proposition 65 warning. Consuming this product can expose you to chemicals, including lead, which are known in the state of California to cause cancer and birth defects or other reproductive harm. And when I looked it up in the internet, it basically said, don't worry about it. So I'm kind of concerned. I would not want to feed that to my grandkids.
Helen, thank you. Scott, mixed messages there.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting example, and thanks, Helen, for sharing it with us. I assume that the lead may be present because of the spices that might be used in your organic pancake mix, but I'd have to look more closely at it. In general, especially organic packaged foods are a better choice if you're trying to avoid all of these unregulated food additives, food chemicals we've been talking about. Right before the break, Kate and I were talking about how while there are many thousands of chemicals that can be used in food, and the vast majority of them are reviewed for safety by the chemical companies, not by the FDA, the organic industry, by rule, by law, has reduced the number of these chemicals that can be added to food as preservatives or colors or flavors to less than 40, which is amazing, in part because it really demonstrates that you really just don't need all of these chemicals to have a really robust packaged food industry. Anyone who's walked in the supermarket has seen that there's an organic alternative in every category in the mm-hmm. center of the store. So organic, as well as our trading partners and around the world, have really shown that a lot of these chemicals are just not needed to have convenient, delicious food in our homes.
And in terms of that disclaimer on the bottom of the box, does that help the manufacturer in some way get away with putting some sort of additive in its ingredient mix?
No.
Okay.
It's a great question. So Prop 65 warnings are required by the state of California if a product, and it might be a food product, it might be your mattress, it might be something else you bring into your home, has a chemical in it that the state of California's regulators have determined cause cancer or birth defects or may cause reproductive harms. And so for companies like the one Helen mentioned that are selling in all 50 states and have, in this case, what sounds like lead at levels that might be of some concern, they are forced to make that disclosure by California state law.
Okay. Talking about food additives with Scott Faber at the Environmental Working Group, you can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Scott, you mentioned heavy metals. Our Attorney General Josh Call, along with 19 other state attorneys general, they recently renewed a request to the FDA to reduce lead levels found in baby food. How does lead end up in baby food?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, there are a number of toxic metals that wind up in baby food because of where they're grown, because there's lead in the soil, or because of how they're grown, because of how we might prepare the soil or irrigate the crop. And there are ways to reduce the amount of toxic metals, including lead and arsenic and other toxic metals that wind up in our baby food. But right now, there's no requirement on our baby food companies to do so. So when companies could change where they source their ingredients, so they're farming in places where there's less of these toxic metals in the soil, or they could change how they're farming, for example, how they irrigate rice to reduce the amount of arsenic that winds up in the rice. But the FDA has been very slow to set standards for these toxic metals in baby food. One game changer that I'll quickly mention, because it's important to our conversation about the role of states, is that the state of California just last year, for the first time, required baby food manufacturers to test their baby food every month for these toxic metals and to make the results publicly available on a website. Mm-hmm. And that lifting that veil of secrecy, requiring testing and reporting, will drive companies to find ways to reduce the amount of metals in baby food. And I wish it didn't have to come to that, but here again, while the FDA has been taking some important steps in the right direction, they're still moving too slow because, you know, 10,000 babies will start eating baby food today. We don't have any time to waste when it comes to babies and the impacts of these toxic metals on their developing brains.
So when you look at that pressure and the role of states, will these statewide bans that are starting to pop up, like by 2027, will that have a meaningful effect on how manufacturers are acting with the ingredients and their additives?
Well, I hope so. And I used to work for the food industry. I'm in regular contact with my friends who work for food companies or represent food companies. And they all realize that this scrutiny that California, Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, many other states are bringing to these chemicals and food is forcing them to think twice and to really think twice about whether chemicals that they've used because it's convenient and legal for many, many decades may no longer make sense to use. Many of them, Peeps is a great example, Easter's right around the corner, have already moved quickly to get Red 3, for example, out of Peeps, which is great news for consumers. And I expect that companies won't wait until 2027 to take out propylparaben and Red 3 and BVO and potassium bromate, the other chemical California banned. But I also expect that companies will start looking at other chemicals that have been banned elsewhere, like BHA and BHT, another preservative called propylgalate, and begin to look for alternatives, regardless of whether or not states or the FDA decide to act. And that's great news. And again, that, you know, Europeans and folks in other countries enjoy all of the same processed food we do. They love their families just as much as we do. They just are lucky that they don't have to eat these toxic chemicals when they bring them into their homes.
I just want to stop there on Peeps because I just checked labels yesterday. I'm still seeing that Red 3, which makes me wonder, is the packaging not keeping up or is the shelf life so long that even if a manufacturer stops using that type of ingredient, that there's going to be a lag time because shelf life is long.
There's always a lag.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I knew I'd strike a chord. I didn't know if it would be with Skittles or Peeps, Kate. So now we know you're a Peeps person. There is a certain lag or what industry calls a tail after they reformulate. There's so much product that's already on the shelves. It takes a year or a year and a half for all of that product, depending on what it is, to ultimately get bought or get out of our pantries and so on. But Peeps has made this commitment. I expect you'll be able to enjoy Peeps without worry very soon.
Let's go to Madeline in Green Bay on that. Madeline, hi.
Hi. I wanted to know about thimerosal mercury that is in some shots as a preservative. Is there some states that forbid that? Some states permit it? Because I'm sure that's very damaging.
And you said thimerosal mercury?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Let's hear some reaction to that.
Yeah, well, so thimerosal is a mercury-based preservative that's used in other products. I'm not aware of it being used in food, but I will definitely look into that for you. Let me do a little research, and you can find me through EWG's website, and I'll get back to you.
All right, Madeline, thank you for that. We have Mark here from Caledonia, Minnesota, wants to talk a little bit about sweeteners. What do you know about sucralose? And Mark has read that it can alter a person's DNA. It's a natural sweetener.
Yeah, it's great. A great question. There are many different kinds of sweeteners, some of which are synthetic, some of which are natural, that are used in all sorts of products as people are looking to avoid sugar. What many of them have in common is they haven't been reviewed for safety by the FDA in a long time. And in particular, many of the synthetic sweeteners haven't been reviewed for many, many decades. I'm going back to the 1970s. What's also really important to note about sweeteners is not only that there are growing health concerns about sweeteners, but that their use, especially as formulators, food companies are trying to continue to get us to enjoy sweet foods, have exploded in the last decade. Between 2013 and 2022, sweeteners in some categories have gone up dramatically by 600%, for example, in, of all things, baby food.
Wow.
By 400% in snacks, cookies, and candy. By 400% in frozen food. So in addition to concerns about some of the health harms that Mark mentioned, there's also concerns about their growing use. And that's important because of what we talked about earlier. One of the reasons FDA should be periodically reviewing the safety of these chemicals isn't just because there's new science, but because they're being used in ways that FDA never imagined when they did reviews in the 1970s or the 1990s. So it's a really important area that needs a lot more regulatory oversight.
And we are examining the landscape of food additives and their potential health impacts. Scott Faber is with the Environmental Working Group, our guide. Call in with a question, add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 10,000 chemicals are allowed to be added to processed foods in America. Many of these widely used chemicals associated with health harms, including increased risks of cancer. That's according to the Environmental Working Group. And we have its Vice President of Governmental Affairs, Scott Faber, with us. Let's go to Matt in Alloway. Matt, hi. You want to bring up sulfites?
Yeah, just a little riff off of what you were saying about sweeteners. I agree, they are just overdone. And the reason I say that and why I'm calling in is because I'm a migraine sufferer. And I get, I used to say that I would get a migraine from it and people would just kind of ignore it. But now when I say that it's like I'm allergic to it and it triggers it, people understand. But sweeteners go into things that you wouldn't even expect, including sweetened cold cereal, and that'll trigger a migraine. The one I'm calling in about is sulfites, especially metabisulfites. They're a preservative that makes things colorful and pretty, and it gets put in our ginger. It gets put in our it used to be just dried fruit, but now it's like crackers and tortillas and if pumpkin spice season comes along and I can't even touch it because there's ginger in there and that ginger has metabisulfites in it.
What a proliferation there. Scott, what is going on?
Yeah, no. And of course, all of the NPR listeners are thinking about sulfites in their red wine, as am I right now. But as Matt mentioned, sulfites have a lot of uses, and they've been linked to a variety of different health effects, especially in people who are sensitive to sulfites, and everything from the problems that Matt described to dermatitis and abdominal pain. And so, it's an area of review that FDA has missed in two ways. One is they are not reviewing these food additives for in general. They're relying on industry to decide whether they're safe, and they're often not looking at some of these other health harms. So one of the challenges with how FDA has historically approached these kinds of questions about, you know, is this particular chemical, when we add it to food, risky? FDA tends to ask, does it cause cancer, and stop there. And it's really important to ask, well, what does chronic exposure, does long-term exposure over and over and over again, not only cause cancer, but does it cause other harms that might come from repeat exposures, like infertility or disrupt our hormone system? And might it cause those acute reactions, those one-time reactions akin to an allergen that we ought to be worried about? So those are, so while there's one big problem we've talked about is FDA doesn't really review these chemicals, the chemical industry does. And even when FDA does, they don't take a second look when there's new science or new uses. The other problem we haven't really talked much about are the harms that FDA tends to look for. And Matt has alluded to some of those harms from that FDA typically has overlooked when it's asked these questions.
Matt, thanks for the call. Will in Seymour is here. Will, what's on your mind?
So my question is, with the many thousands of essentially unregulated chemicals out there, why are these bills in Illinois and California so narrow in scope, only banning a handful of them?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was Will, right?
It is Will.
Name,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Will, great question. I can't speak for regulators in California or Illinois or New York, but when they've looked at this question and asked which chemicals are the worst of the worst, they've tended to look at two things. So one is, what are our trading partners doing? And that isn't just folks in Europe. It's many other countries have banned some of these chemicals or severely restricted their use either to certain categories or certain amounts. So they first look at that question of, well, can you make this stuff, the same stuff, without these chemicals? And then the second question they'll often look at is, what do we know about the science? Are there peer-reviewed studies about cancer, about effects on the reproductive system, on the hormone system? Are they neurotoxic? And to their credit, a lot of these legislators are exercising a little humility and saying, well, you know, we have to act. FDA is failing to protect consumers. We have to act to protect consumers, but we want to be cautious about banning chemicals unless we know that they're dangerous. And they've looked again to the evidence to answer that question. And we know that these same companies are making them elsewhere without these chemicals. So So I think they're being thoughtful about putting together these chemicals to target, because they, you know, again, that, you know, I think we all wish FDA would do what Congress imagined in 1958, but unfortunately that just yet hasn't happened.
Paula from Appleton called in to ask, how can consumers urge the government to make this a bigger priority?
Well, thanks, Paula. And so first and foremost, there are a lot of great state legislators in Wisconsin who I'm sure would love to hear from you, or probably watching what their colleagues in other states are doing. So go reach out to your state legislators and urge them to follow the lead of states like California, New York, Illinois. But in addition to that, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from your neighboring state of Illinois, and represents Chicago, has also introduced legislation to simply require FDA to periodically review these chemicals. She's identified many of the same chemicals and introduced a bill, the Food Chemical Reassessment Act, that would simply require FDA to give them a second look. And she's worked with another congresswoman from Connecticut, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, to close this loophole that has allowed for 64 years now, I get that right, 66 years, oh my gosh, 66 years now, to let the chemical companies decide what's safe. No one who's listening to our conversation, Kate, thinks it's the chemical companies who make the chemicals who should decide that they're safe to eat, right? Nobody thinks that makes sense. So yeah, really. So call your Congress critters and urge them to support those two bills.
Well, meanwhile, do you have some tips for us on reading labels on these processed foods when we may not have the vocabulary or, you know, to know really what's what on these labels?
Well, we've actually tried to make that a little easier for you at EWG. We've created a database called Food Scores. So if you just go to EWG.org and you plug in Food Scores, you will see many of your favorite packaged foods, processed foods, scored for you on a 1 to 10 scale. One of the factors that we take into account is the toxicity of the chemicals in those products. And you can learn more about why we are concerned about those health harms of those particular chemicals at Food Scores at EWG.org.
And as we wrap up here, what are you watching for next in terms of food additives and chemicals and the different forces that are happening within the federal government and in states?
Well, you know, I'm hopeful that more states will follow California's lead. Again, there are many thousands. We don't know precisely how many, but thousands and thousands of chemicals added to food. The vast majority have never been reviewed by FDA, but most of them are probably safe. There are a handful of chemicals. We've talked about some of them today, BVO, propylparaben, Red 3, some of the other colors, BHA, BHT, that may not be safe and are unnecessary. We're making all the foods we love without them. So I'm hopeful that states will continue to protect us. And I'm also very hopeful that FDA with new leadership will finally, give us what we all expect.
Scott, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Scott Faber, Senior Vice President for Government Affairs with the Environmental Working Group. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.